offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and I welcome you, dear listeners, to this week's episode of the Gita series. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it gives me great pleasure to join you again this week in the continuation of the program that we've been doing, where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. We started the 10th chapter called the Vibhuti Yoga a couple of weeks back. So we will, as always, start with a short summary of what we covered last time, because I took up two verses, verses 4 and 5, which we did partially. Some of the statements that Krishna makes in that couple of verses will be clarified today. We'll speak about that today. So we'll start with what we covered last week. In these verses, essentially, Krishna lists out the various attributes that are to be recognized as being vibhutis or divine expressions of the glory of the Supreme Lord. And each of these attributes can be seen in everyday life as simple traits and also as very saintly qualities. That's the spectrum that these statements or these words that Krishna uses cover, and I think that's what we tried to go through last week. But it is important to firstly see them as simple qualities of all beings, and not simply to look at them in awe and say that, oh, these are all superhuman traits. That's why in the end of the 5th verse is the statement that Krishna makes, Bhavanti bhava bhutanam matta eva prithag vidaha. Krishna says, I am talking about bhava bhutanam, qualities of normal beings. Prithag vidaha. They are different in nature. Bhavanti matta eva. Though they are different, though they are simple qualities, they certainly arise from me. So I'll quickly summarize the qualities that we covered last time before completing, as I said, the few that were left out. The first two that Krishna starts with are buddhi and jnana. Buddhi, or intellect, as we saw, is the ability to see that which is subtle. The subtle patterns, the subtle connections. A very important trait that is required for any basic form of learning, be it arithmetic, science, or astronomy. It is all about seeing hidden patterns. Next comes jnana, the knowledge that is gained by using the buddhi in the manner that was mentioned, the ability to see subtle patterns. So buddhi is the ability to see the subtle, and jnana, that is the knowledge or the body of knowledge that is gathered using the buddhi. He says both of these come from God. Another meaning for this statement is that all knowledge comes from God, in the sense when God creates something, all knowledge related to that is also created along with that. So with creation, this entire universe that we see, with the creation of this universe, all knowledge pertaining to that universe was also created with it. What we are doing with the use of our intellect is nothing but exploring that knowledge bit by bit. We are not creating any new knowledge. Any knowledge of the stars is only revealed over a period of exploration, right? Nothing has been created in that sense. So looking at it from that point of view, all knowledge comes from God, and this buddhi through which we explore this knowledge also comes from God. The next word that Krishna mentions is asammohaha, non-delusion or clarity. When you have knowledge, or importantly, subtle knowledge about a concept, you will have clarity. You will not think of it as being something else. If I know a pen, I will not look at it and think that it is something else, right? So a knowledge of something gives clarity about what it is, and the scope of thinking it is something else or to be deluded is removed, right? So sammohaha is also a vibhuti which is sourced from God. As we can see, these three are qualities we find in everyday life. We need this for simple gathering of knowledge, for simple going about doing our work. But the supreme manifestation of these three are buddhi, that is able to see the truth that this world is mithya, what we refer to as nitya anitya vichara viveka, the spiritual buddhi, right? The supreme manifestation of simple buddhi is that spiritual buddhi. The jnana that comes out of this spiritual buddhi or this vichara using this buddhi is atma jnana, the knowledge of the self, and which is nothing but brahma jnana, the knowledge of Brahman. And the asammoha that comes out of this is that complete overcoming of maya or delusion. Then Krishna says, kshama, forgiveness or forbearance. Again, a quality that is mundane as well as spiritual. A very important quality that is mandatory for social life. And one can be infinitely forgiving. And if one has such a nature, one will be looked up as a saintly person. We went through the example of a saint like Sant Eknath. Then Krishna says, satya, or truth in spoken word. We discussed how merely the ability to convey in words what has been seen or experienced or understood is itself a blessing. It's a quality that does not come so easily. And that miracle is manifest in an advanced manner in human life compared to animals, plants, and of course minerals. And as a noble quality, it manifests as honesty and integrity. And somebody who has those qualities will be looked up as a Mahatma or a noble person. But even for normal communication, normal existence, you need satya, truth in spoken word. The next two qualities Krishna mentions are dhamakshamaha, control of the external organs and limbs, and the control of the internal instruments, the antakarnas or the mind to a certain extent. Again, we may look at these as spiritual qualities. The moment you say self-control, sense control, mind control, we think of these as spiritual traits. But without a certain amount of self-control, we cannot accomplish anything in life. We cannot lead a simple life. We cannot lead a sane life. We have the ability to stop ourselves from performing certain actions, expressing certain thoughts that come in our mind. And we also have the ability to look at a thought and say, I don't want to continue this train of thought, and stop it there. If we do not have that quality, we will all become insane, right? So for a regular, sane, mature, simple life, you need a certain amount of dhamma and shama. And Krishna says, that is a vibhuti of the Lord. Then Krishna says, sukham dukham cha. Sukha and dukha. Happiness and sorrow. Sukha is understandable, as we've discussed any number of times earlier. All repository of ananda or happiness is only in the self, the atma. The actions that we perform, events that happen in our life, only enable us to fetch that ananda from within, right? So in that sense, when you say that all ananda comes from the Lord, it is understandable. And without simple happiness, again, you cannot lead life, right? So that is why the simple pleasures and happiness that we undergo in life have to be looked upon as the manifestation of God's glory. How is dukkham or sorrow vibhuti? God has purposely put pain and suffering in the world so that we will not get attached to it and so that we will turn in search of the truth. God has made this world anityam and asukham. Anityam, we will come to that. Asukham, not capable of giving us complete happiness, so that we will turn within in search of that true happiness. Then Krishna goes on to say, bhavaha abhavaha. Bhavaha, birth or existence, is a vibhuti of Lord. Everything that comes into existence, from a child that is born, to say a project that sees the light of the day, anything that manifests is a sign of is vibhuti. Similarly, something coming to an end is also an expression of his grace. Pain coming to an end, problems resolving, or for that matter, even death is a vibhuti of the Lord. Because transience is a quality that is put in the world by God. He has made the lok, he has made the world anityam and asukham, right? Asukham is also a vibhuti of the Lord. Anityam or transience is also a vibhuti of the Lord that can be seen in everyday life. Anityam is possible only because God performs this miracle of abhavaha or dematerializing. So those are the many words that we went through from verses 4 and 5. As I said, there were a few that were left out. So we will go through them also in the first part of today's episode. The next set of opposites like sukham and dukham, bhava and abhavaha, what Krishna mentions is bhayam cha abhayam, fear and fearlessness. This is interesting. Krishna says fear is also a manifestation of the Lord. Fearlessness is also a manifestation of the Lord. He says fear and awe is a vibhuti. What does that mean? What are we fearful about? What makes us look at something in awe and say that, oh, I fear this, both in a positive and a negative way? That which is irrevocable, that which is beyond me, that which is relentless, and nothing that I can do can change its course. Such things I'm fearful about, right? If I fear a system, if I fear a government, an oppressive government system, it means there is nothing that I can do that will change this government, do whatever it is doing, right? That is what we are scared of. That which is irrevocable, that which is relentless. Not just things that hurt or harm us. That which hurt or harm us becomes a subset of these things, right? The fear of harm comes when I have a preference and someone can come and do something to challenge that preference that I have. When we look at the laws of creation are irrevocable, isn't it? Death is inevitable. Karma is inevitable. These are all fixed laws that strike fear and awe in us, isn't it? All these can be sourced to God. And when we realize this, we will, as it is said in the Bible famously, fear only God. When we see all of these relentless and inevitable things as being the vibhuti of the Lord, we will say, the only person who needs to be looked up with fear and awe is the Lord himself and no one else. And it is this fear of God that will keep us on track. As Swami has explained in one of the discourses, and I think I have mentioned this even in one of our discussions earlier, bhakti, one of the definitions of devotion that Swami gives is love filled with awe or fear, right? So that fear is also a very important component of bhakti. The fear of displeasing Swami is what keeps each one of us in track, isn't it? There's a very beautiful line in the Brahmanandavali where this aspect of God and fear of God is mentioned. It goes, Bhishasmadvatav pavate, Bhishadeti suryah, Bhishasmadagnischa indrascha, Mrityurdhavati panchama iti. It means, Bhishasmadvatav pavate, through fear of him blows the wind. Bhishodheti suryaha, through fear of him the sun rises. Bhishasmadagnischendrascha, through fear of him again the fire and moon function. Mrityurdhavati panchama iti, and lastly in the fifth, death too proceeds to do its task out of fear. And that is why it is said, this fear, this awe of the Supreme Being is what holds this entire world together. He says, I am bhaya. And then he says, I am abhayam too. Fearlessness is also a vibhuti of the Lord. Fearlessness, abhayam, if you look at it, is the source for adventurism in life, isn't it? Krishna had said to Arjuna, be a dhira, be a brave one. Where does that bravery and courage come from? It comes from this abhayam aspect that Krishna is speaking about here. It comes from God. When you know God is by your side, even if the whole world is before you, that fearlessness is sourced to God. That is a vibhuti of the Lord. That's what Krishna is saying here. There's, you must have heard this this explanation any number of times on the other programs, where one of the students was once saying that when he was asked to deliver a talk in Swami's presence, when he went up to the podium, he was filled with so much of nervousness, because it is said that among the many phobias that exist in the world, that which is ranked right on top is the fear of public speaking. And there he was, faced in front of these thousands of devotees who were sitting in front of him, and he had to deliver his talk, and he was filled with so much fear. And in that nervousness, he looked at Swami and made eye contact with Swami. Swami also looked at him, and Swami smiled, and Swami indicated that he can start. And he said that in that one moment, this thought came to him, that here he was standing with thousands of people facing him. And that was what was causing the fear, right? You're one person, you're facing 1,000 people, and you have to speak something. But when he turned and looked at Swami, for those of you who have been in Prashanta Nilayam, who have seen that scene, Swami's chair or throne will be placed right in the center of the portico, and the podium for the speaker would be placed beside Swami, just a few feet away. So when he turned and looked at Swami, this feeling filled his mind, saying that I may be faced with thousands of people, but beside me is the Lord of the Lords, right? Swami is beside me, and that should make me fearless. And that fearlessness that comes from this thought that God is beside me, the whole world can be against me, it doesn't matter, as long as Swami is beside me, I don't have anything to fear. So that is abhaya. To look at abhaya as a supreme manifestation, to believe, to have the confidence that I can go beyond this human state, I can reach the divine state, that calls for courage and confidence, isn't it? And we all have it. Without at least a bit of that, none of us will be spiritual aspirants. We have the belief, we have the confidence that I can go beyond this limited human state, or this imperfect human state that I am stuck in right now. That is what makes us a spiritual aspirant. So that abhaya is there in each one of us inherently. And that, Swami says, is a vibhuti of the Lord. That ultimate fearlessness comes from oneness. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says, dvitiyat vai bhayam bhavati. Where there is duality, there is fear. Fear manifests or exists out of this duality. Dvitiyat vai bhayam bhavati. So true fearlessness comes from the Atma, or the oneness of Atma, right? So that is why the simple manifestation of fearlessness, that is what we see as adventurousness, or the risk-taking ability that we see in everyday life, to the fearlessness that comes from faith, to the fearlessness, the ultimate fearlessness that comes from oneness of the Atma. This is the whole spectrum of abhayam that Krishna is speaking about. All of this is an expression of my glory. Then Krishna says, ahimsa, non-injury or non-violence. This again is a fundamental quality, the desire to not be hurt, and hence the desire not to hurt others. That is the foundation of morality itself. Ahimsa paramo dharma, Swami would say. Non-injury of others is the supreme morality, or the basis of all dharma. Help ever, hurt never is the essence of all scriptures, right? We've heard that from Swami many times. That was the conclusion that sage Vyasa comes to after going through all the scriptures, Upanishads and the Puranas. He says, help ever, hurt never. This is the ultimate message. And in that, even if you cannot help, Swami would say, try not to hurt others. So this is the basis of all moral code, all dharma. And it is a quality that is there spontaneously in each one of us. So the basic goodness in human nature is ahimsa, and that ahimsa is an expression of divinity. And in humans, you find the highest expression of this same quality, where you are ready to sacrifice your own benefits, your own your own profits in the name of selflessness, right? Even if I get hurt, it is okay. If someone is happy, I'm willing to do it. That's what is self-sacrifice and selflessness. Again, a quality through which God shines in everyday life. Then Krishna says, samata, equanimity, a quality that is closely associated with kshama that we just discussed, or forbearance. What is this equanimity? The ability to maintain one's balance when there are changes happening around us. Can you imagine life without this quality? Imagine if we could not tolerate any change in temperature or weather. If we could live only in one fixed temperature condition, or say humidity condition. Today, mankind is spread all across the globe. Man can live in all kinds of conditions, from the hottest regions in the equator to the North Pole. That ability is a sign of equanimity born of tolerance, isn't it? The same quality allows us to maintain our calm through the uncertainties that life throws at us. And this quality is in its most supreme state. In the most simple state, it is the equanimity that is related to the physical conditions. It also manifests as a mature mental state. It also manifests as a spiritual maturity. And in its supreme expression, it is the form of samadhi. As Swami would say, samadhi, where the mind is in a state of complete equanimity. Samata is then followed by tushtihi, contentment. The ultimate contentment will only come when we are able to identify with the Atma within. Krishna had described the Jnani in the third chapter as someone who is a Atma Tripta, Atmani Eva Santushta. When he identifies with the Self within, he is complete. He is an Atma Tripta. He is satisfied with himself, Atmani Eva Santushta. All his happiness and contentment is drawn from the Self within. He doesn't need anything else outside to fulfill him. So that Atma Santushta is the ultimate contentment. That is when God shines in all his glory in an individual, when somebody has that Atma Santushta. But that simple contentment we feel is also an expression of his glory. We experience it every day. Again, something without which we cannot live. When after a long walk in the sun, we come home and drink a sip of cool water, that feeling of contentment should remind us of God. Or after a long day's work, we get good sleep. How much contentment is there in that deep sleep that we are able to get? Or imagine after years of struggle, we accomplish a dream. Either you become a doctor, you become, you've labored and you've set up a business. And finally, you see that business is becoming successful. That contentment that comes at the end of labor, that contentment is a manifestation of God's glory. That sensation of fulfillment that fills our heart is God shining through that moment. So think of it something like a lamp that is covered by, say, a pot with holes. The small contentment that we feel as we go through life with desires being fulfilled and satisfied and so on is like the light that is shining through one of the holes of that pot. The light is coming because there is a lamp inside. It is coming from the same lamp, but it comes from different holes. And that Atma Tripta or Atma Santushta that we're talking about is like when you're able to completely lift the pot, or when you break the pot, then the light shines in all its glory. right? That breaking of the pot or lifting of the pot is what is giving up of body consciousness. Then Krishna says, tapaha, austerity. What is austerity? Swami would often say this, and we have gone through this in the series already, because when Krishna said in the 7th chapter, tapaha cha asmi tapasvishu, right? There he said, I am the austerity in the austere or in the ascetics. And we also discuss about tapas, for those of you who want to go back and refer, when we spoke about abhyasa, when Arjuna spoke about the wavering nature of the mind, Krishna said, yes, the mind is like that. That is the nature of the mind. But it can be controlled by vairagya and abhyasa. At that point, when we discussed abhyasa, we saw that Swami said abhyasa is nothing but tapas. So the ultimate form of tapas is alignment of the body, mind and the intellect to the Atma. But in simple everyday use, this aligning of thought, word and deed is what is referred to as tapas. To achieve anything, right? That's why Krishna had called abhyasa is required when Arjuna was asking about the wavering mind. The wavering mind is a problem not only for the spiritual accomplishment. The wavering mind is a problem even for mundane accomplishments. If I want to do something, if I want to study, if I want to concentrate and do a task, the restless nature of the mind becomes an obstacle, right? So what do? We take a resolve. We're saying that no, this work has to be accomplished today, so I'm going to be at it. So you take a resolve and you align your mental faculties and your body to that task. And that itself is a form of tapas. The ability to take control of our faculties and direct it in the direction of one particular goal is a quality that is prerequisite for achieving anything in life, and that is tapas, and that is a vibhuti of the Lord. This is something as simple as the act of even taking food from plate and eating it, right? How many various aspects of the body have to come together to perform that simple task? Since we do it every day, we don't stop and wonder about it. Most of you who are listening would have completed some basic education or the other. It is impossible to complete your schooling or get a degree without a certain amount of this quality in you. The ability to take charge of your life and take charge of your time and say that I will perform this or I will accomplish this. It is possible only because of tapas shakti. And that tapas, Krishna says, is a manifestation of the Lord. And the supreme expression of that tapas is when you're able to completely hold your mind still, body still, and you're able to focus on the self, right? And that is what we often see as tapas. A tapasvi is one who is able to do that all his day. But truly speaking, that quality of tapas is present in each one of us, and because of that alone, we are able to do even the smallest of tasks. Then Krishna says, danam, beneficence or charity, that is also a vibhuti. If you look at it, danam is a sign of maturity. As I said, self-sacrifice is an advanced expression of ahimsa in human beings. The maturity to know that there is something there to be gained even when you are giving away. If you give me something, of course I'm gaining out of it. I'm acquiring something. But it requires maturity to think that even when I'm giving what I have away, I am gaining something. A gain that is internal, invisible, and indeed non-material. In the current situation that we're all going through, when there is so much suffering around, when we see people who are going out of their way to help others, to relieve someone's pain, I mean, nobody's asking them to do in most cases. They are going out on their own and doing. When you listen to such episodes, there is an inexplicable joy and warmth that you feel, right? Even when you see it in social media or you see it in everyday life, when somebody is going out of their way and doing some charity or doing some help, there is an inexplicable joy that you feel when you see stories like that. Because without our knowledge, we are being reminded of the divinity that is present in that person. Right? We are recognizing that vibhuti of the Lord through that act of charity. Then finally, Krishna says, yashaha, fame, and ayashaha, infamy. Yashaha and ayashaha are vibhutis of the Lord. Adi Shankara in his commentary gives a very crisp definition for yasha. He says, dharma nimitta kirtihi. Dharma nimitta kirtihi. The name, the kirti that one gets when one follows dharma. And the explanation is that when dharma or goodness is itself an expression of God, then the fame that is acquired through aligning one's life to dharma can be also spoken of as belonging to God, right? Similarly, when you say a talent is a vibhuti of God, the fame that one acquires on account of that talent also belongs to God, isn't it? But how is ayashaha or infamy also to be seen as a vibhuti or expression of divinity? The explanation that Adi Shankara gives and many other commentators give is very simple. Just like how you gain name by following dharma, you earn ayashaha or infamy by not following dharma. So even for ayashaha, dharma is the basis or the source. Of course, I'm not going to contest that idea, but I will add another point of view to that. How to see bad name that we get also as a miracle of God, and I think this is a very important point for devotees. Or the point is, we should ensure that even when we are going through infamy, that should remind us of God or make us feel grateful, because that ayashaha, just like how fame is a manifestation of the Lord, ayashaha, infamy that comes to us, especially when it comes to us without we seeking it or without doing anything to deserve it, should be seen as a vibhuti of the Lord. This was shared by a very senior Balvikas teacher once when I was talking to her, and I think this was a story that she had heard from Swami a very long time ago. I'm just trying to recall it from memory, so I will be giving you the essence of the story that you said. Some of the facts are not exactly verbatim, as Swami said, because I don't think this was spoken of by Swami in a discourse, so I don't have a reference for that. The story is about Sant Meera, Mother Meera. One day when she was in a very downcast mood and was crying why she was not able to have darshan of her Krishna, the story goes that she goes to the balcony of the palace where there is nobody, and in solitude she starts crying and talking to Krishna. And she says, "O Lord, when will I have your darshan? When will I be worthy of your love, O Krishna?" She then has a vision where Krishna speaks to her. And Krishna says, "O Meera, what can I do? Do you see that thick, dark clouds up there?" Krishna says, pointing to a big, dark, black cloud up in the sky. Mother Meera looks at it, and Krishna continues. He says, "That thick dark cloud is the karma of your past. As long as that thick dark cloud is there, how can you see the sun?" And having had this vision, Meera bursts out into tears. She says, "Oh Krishna, what do I do then? What do I do? I don't know what to do to get rid of that cloud. Is there no hope for me? Will I never be able to have a vision of yours?" Then Krishna tells her, "Okay, I will do what it takes to get rid of the cloud. You don't have to do anything about it. You don't have to worry about it." The story goes that shortly thereafter, some rumors started spreading about the character of Mother Meera. People started speaking that she had some illicit relationship and she was unfaithful to the Rana, her husband. And such things started spreading, and she was deeply pained, being a very pious soul that she was. And she was wondering why suddenly all these stories have come and she has not done anything, and why are people talking ill about her? when she has not done anything wrong. And again, after a few days, she goes out into the balcony seeking that solitude. And again, she starts crying to Krishna. She says, Krishna, what sin have I done? Why are people speaking ill of me? I know nothing but to love you. I know nothing but to worship you. Why are people talking ill about me? Then again, Krishna tells her, Oh Mother, Oh Meera, look up now. And this time when she looks up, she sees the same dark cloud, but now it is much, much smaller in size. And then she realizes that through all this ayasha, which she was not responsible in any way, Krishna was getting rid of all her past karmas, which were stopping her from reaching her Lord. Right? So when ayasha or infamy comes to you for no mistake of yours, you have not done anything to deserve it, you have not done anything wrong, but still people are talking ill of you, take a moment and thank Swami, because He is taking you closer to Him. This is a very, very important point that we have to keep in mind, because Swami says Kirti is very important. In His discourses, Swami says Satyam Kirti Dvayam Sthiram. He says Kirti is very important because in the pursuit of Yasha or Kirti, we will maintain a moral life, right? That's why Adi Shankara gives that beautiful definition for Yasha. If you lead a moral life, you will automatically get a good name. So we do lead a good life in pursuit of that Yasha, but it doesn't mean that Ayasha is a curse. Ayasha or infamy is also a vibhuti of the Lord, and when it comes to us, for no mistake of ours, it should remind us that Swami is taking this opportunity to take us close to Him. There's another story about this, but I don't think we'll have time for that. Maybe if there is time, I will share at the end of the episode. So all these qualities that Krishna spoke about in verses 4 and 5, Krishna says, Bhavanti bhava bhutanam matta eva pritak vidaha. These different dispositions or qualities of beings, bhutanam, spring from me alone. To quickly repeat all those qualities that Krishna mentioned, buddhir jnanam, intellect and wisdom, asammoha, non-delusion or clarity, kshama satyam, forbearance and truth, damashamaha, control of external organs and control of the mind, sukham dukham, happiness and sorrow, bhavaha, abhavaha, coming into existence and ceasing to exist, bhayam cha abhayam, fear or awe and fearlessness, ahimsa samata, non-injury and equanimity, tushtihi, contentment, tapaha danam, austerity and charity, yashaha ayashaha, good and bad name. So the idea is to see all these as manifestations of the Lord in our everyday experience, and also in the most supreme version of each of these qualities that we invariably attribute to great beings, right? In fact, next Krishna is going to speak about such great individuals who epitomize some of these qualities. The reason why we went through in detail about each one of these is we know all of these qualities, right? When you say samatha, satya, ahimsa, these are not qualities that we don't know about. For any person who's been regularly reading spiritual literature or has been listening to Swami's discourses, we know some of these qualities. Even if you have not read or heard Swami's discourses, you recognize these qualities as noble qualities. But then we look at them in so much awe that we think that these are two noble qualities to associate with me. I'm a very simple person, I'm a worldly person. But the reason why it was important to discuss these in detail is we all have these qualities within us, and without them we cannot lead a normal, regular life. To recognize them as we go through life becomes a very important quality of sadhaka, as Krishna is going to say in the next couple of verses. But in the next verse, the sixth verse, Krishna is going to speak about those individuals in whom this manifests in a complete form. So we'll listen to the 6th verse of the 10th chapter. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail what Krishna conveys there.
Maharshayas Sapta Purve Chatvaro Manavastatha Madbhava Manasa Jata Yeshan Loka Imaf Praja.
The 7 great seers of yore, and similarly the 4 Manus, all possessing my mental disposition, were born of my mind. All these creatures of the world have descended from them. So that is the 6th verse of the 10th chapter. Krishna in this shloka refers to the Maharishayaha Sapta, the great Saptarishis, and Manavaha or the Manus. Different commentators have different views on this. Why only 4 Manus when there are actually 14 Manus in the scriptures? And even about the Saptarishis, various scriptures name a different set of rishis as the Saptarishis. The Mahabharata names a set, and also it is believed that this Saptarishis change from different Manvantaras, right? Different Manvantaras have a different set of Saptarishis. So when Krishna says Maharishaya Sapta Purve, some say that he is referring to the previous Manvantara. So they name the 7 set of Saptarishis from that period of time. Some other scholars say it is Maharishaya Sapta, the 7 Rishis, Purve Chatvaro, the 4 great ones who came before the Saptarishis, which means the 4 Kumaras or the 4 Manasaputras of Brahma, Sanaka Kumara, Sanatana, Sanandana, Sanat Kumara, the 4 Manasaputras of Lord Brahma. They are supposed to be, they are called the 4 great ones, right? So some people say that it should be broken this way, Maharishaha Sapta, the 7 Rishis, Purve Chatvaro, the 4 great ones who came before them, and Manavastatha, and the Manus. If you ask me, it really doesn't matter how we resolve or which commentator we should follow. And since Swami has not written about this or spoken in his discourses, there is no way for me to take a stand and say that this is the right interpretation, so I will not do that. But what is important is the idea that is being conveyed in this shloka. And we will try to dwell on that. That is more important. The Puranas have the description of how creation comes about, right? First, Brahma is the original being that is born out of the energy of the Supreme Lord, known as Hiranyagarbha. And from Brahma comes, as we said, the 4 Kumaras, the great sages, the Saptarishis, and the 14 Manus. They all manifest from Brahma. And it is believed that this entire creation are in some way descendants of these. That's why, since all human beings come from the various Manus, we are called Manavas, right? That's how it comes. And every family are seen as descendant of any one of these Saptarishis. And that's where the concept of Gotra comes in India. We follow that even today. We say that Swami was born in Bharadwaj Gotra, right? Apastamba Sutra Bharadwaj Gotra, we say. Which means that Bharadwaja was one of the Saptarishis. It is his bloodline, his ancestry in which this particular individual is born. In our case, Bhagwan is born in that family line. Similarly, there is Gautama Gotra, Vishwamitra Gotra, so on and so forth. Why is Krishna referring to these sages and great beings? In fact, he mentions in the next line, Madbhavaha. They are ones whose minds are resolved in me. It also means they have powers like me. Bhavaha means attributes. So Madbhavaha means they have attributes that are similar to mine. Which means These are beings who have managed to let the divine effulgence shine through them almost perfectly without any interference or obstructing that divine to express itself. We look up to them, their abilities and their enormous powers, right? We look at them in awe. Krishna is stating here, it is his divine glory that shines through them. As they have their minds completely aligned with him, and that is why that effulgence shines more compared to other beings. The same qualities that you see in the Saptarishis, as we've been seeing, that is what was the endeavor in the past episode and this one, that these are all qualities that are in us, probably in the form of a seed, right? But it is manifested in them in their complete form because they have aligned their mind and other faculties with the Lord, right? Then Krishna says, Manasaha Jataha, from my mind they all are born. Yesham Loka Imaha Prajaha, and from them all the people of the world. Imagine if I am a descendant of a great king, if I was born in a royal family, or let's say I was born in the family of some great ustad, right, of some gharana who says that, oh, you belong to this family of these great ustads. I will claim so much pride in that, isn't it? Oh, I'm the son of this great king, or I'm the great grandson of this great ustad. And I will somewhere feel that I must also have those traits that made them great the way they were. We see so much racism and casteism in the world. It all comes from this false pride that I am a descendant of this particular community or this particular group or this particular race, isn't it? Through this shloka, Krishna is asking us, do you realize you all are descendants of that Supreme Being? Do we take pride in that? Swami would say, the scriptures say, you are Amritasya Putraha. You are children of immortality. But because we identify with the body, because of our body consciousness, we end up thinking that we are Anritasya Putraha, or children of Anrita, falsehood. So the ultimate vibhuti of the Lord, or the collective vibhuti, is each one of us, right? We are descendants of that Supreme Being. Of course, there is a process where Krishna says the Supreme Being manifested the Brahman manifested the four Kumaras, and then the Saptarishis, and the Saptarishis, the Manus, and so on and so forth. Finally, it comes down to you and me speaking to you and you listening to me. The point is, we in totality are the divine manifestation of the Lord, right? We are the collective vibhuti, each one of us, of that Supreme Lord. Because we falsely identify with the body, and hence with all things that are related to the body, like parentage, lineage, religion, nationality, caste, and all kinds of things, we forget this lineage with that Supreme Lord. We forget that we are truly Amritasya Putraha. Swami would say, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of mankind. I think that is what is being reiterated in this particular shloka, where Krishna speaks about the Saptarishis, the Manus, and the Kumaras. We'll go to the next shloka, because Krishna makes a very important point in the next one, and it will kind of complete this discussion that we are having about recognizing these vibhutis. The seventh shloka is also important for another reason. You will understand it as soon as you listen to it. So we'll listen to the seventh shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss in detail.
Etam vibhutim yogancha mama yo veti tattvataha so vikampena yogena yujyate natra samshayaha
He who rightly understands my manifested glory and my creative power, beyond doubt, attains perfect peace. So that is the 7th verse of the 10th chapter. So you would have guessed what I was referring to. This is the shloka where you find the name of the chapter, Vibhuti Yoga, occurring. But the meaning of yoga here is a little different from when it is given as a title of a chapter. We'll come to that. Till now, Krishna spoke about the various manifestations of his, the various vibhutis. Here he states, what is the effect or impact of knowing this or recognizing this? And as always, knowing is not simply a means of information. We have gone through these verses in the past couple of weeks. Now we all know these are all the vibhutis of the Lord. It is not knowing of that kind, as we have always said. True knowing is that which has gone through the three stages of jnatum, drashtum, praveshtum, where the knowledge becomes part of our spontaneous thinking. So what happens when one knows the vibhutis of the Lord like that? That is mentioned in the shloka. And it's no surprise, because this is something that we have come across many times in the Gita already. Krishna says, Ye Veti, one who knows tattvatah truly, Yetam Vibhutim Mama, this glory of mine, or this vibhuti of mine, Krishna says, Yetam Vibhutim Yogam Chamama, one who knows my vibhuti and my connection with it. So here, yogam is used in the meaning of union or connected to it, right? When in the chapter name, when we say Vibhuti Yoga, it means that chapter where the knowledge of the Vibhuti of the Lord is discussed. But here when Krishna says, Yetam Vibhutim Yogam Chamama, one who knows my Vibhuti and my connection with it, one who knows my vibhuti and my connection with it in its tattva, right? That's the other important thing. Yetam vibhutim yogam cha mama yo veti tattvatah. One who knows this in tattva, in true sense. What is the essence of what Krishna is saying here? Why is he saying that you should recognize and know by vibhuti and also the connection to it? We will come to that, because that is the most critical aspect. Let's see what Krishna says will happen to this person. We'll get that out of the way, so to say. Right? He says, Saha, he or such a person, avikalpena yogena yujyate. The person attains avikalpena yoga, meaning a state of unwavering yoga or unwavering unity. Na atra samshayaha. There is no doubt about that. As I said, this part is not surprising. The same ultimate state that is reached, that cannot be taken away from the aspirant, is what is described here. It is described as avikalpena yoga. That union which cannot be disturbed. Going back to that statement that Swami made, to know God's vibhuti and his connection with it. There's a beautiful quote from one of Swami's discourses that I will read out, and you will see what is the idea behind speaking about God and his vibhuti, and the important point of always remembering that the vibhuti is always connected to the Lord. This is a discourse that Swami delivered on the 7th of March 1982. I will read out, and then maybe I will highlight a few points. Swami says, and I quote, Brahman is the cause and Prakriti the effect. Prakriti or nature is the deluding manifestation of Brahman. It is what can be called Leela Vibhuti, or expression of glow done as a mere Leela or sport. When the Leela is perceived as apart from Brahman, it is a false and incomplete perception. The Leela is manifold. Brahman is one. To discover the one in the many is the purpose of human existence. Brahman is eternal. It is the Nitya Vibhuti or the everlasting splendor. Leela Vibhuti is Prakriti or Maya or Avidya. With the deluding deceptive diversities, the objective world, Leela Vibhuti, is the superimposition on Brahman that deceives and distorts the reality. Ignorant persons assume it to be real. End of quote. Swami gives a beautiful explanation of these vibhutis and how they are different from Brahman and how in reality they are not different from Brahman. Swami refers to Brahman as the Nitya Vibhuti, that expression that is endless. Very beautifully, he says Nitya Vibhuti. If I were to express my feelings through a short talk or through an article, through words in that sense, there will be a point where I will start my expression. There will be a point where I end my expression, right? So every expression is limited in that sense. But here Swami is describing Brahman as the Nitya Vibhuti, the total manifestation of the Supreme Glory, the endless manifestation of the Supreme Glory. There is no beginning and end to this manifestation, which means it is the absolute, right? We are only giving it the name Vibhuti, but truly speaking, it is the absolute itself. And this creation, or every aspect of creation as we see it, Swami says, is the Leela Vibhuti, a limited, playful manifestation of God. And there are manifold, there are many types of it, as we have seen, all these qualities that we spoke about, every being that we encounter, every aspect of nature that we encounter, all of these are the manifold manifestations of that Leela Vibhuti. When the Leela is perceived as being apart from Brahman, it is a false and incomplete perception, right? That is the point that Swami made. I was just reading out the exact statement that Swami made there. When the Leela is perceived as being apart from the Brahman, it is a false and incomplete perception. And that is the point that Krishna is making in this verse. One is to recognize all these traits as being divine and as not ever being separate from Him. Yo veti tatvataha, the one who knows this truly, so avikalpena yogena yujyate na atra samshayaha. It's a very important thing that Krishna makes in this point. When we speak about the vibhutis of the Lord, so the two words that Swami used, and that's why I made it a point to quote that particular discourse clipping, Nitya Vibhuti and Leela Vibhuti. All that we encounter in our life, right, even the miracles that Swami performs in any number of homes around the world, be it the manifestation of Vibhuti, Amritam, or somebody's ailment being cured miraculously, these are all Leela Vibhutis of the Lord. And these alone are not Leela Vibhutis of the Lord, as we saw, the ability to speak, the ability to stand, the ability to accomplish a task, the ability to take up to spiritual sadhana, all of these are various Leela Vibhutis of the Lord. So the first point is to recognize these as manifestations and expressions of His divine glory. The second step is to see that at no point these manifestations are separate from that Supreme Lord. You can never separate the wave from the water, right? It is only our perception, our language, we have given it a name, we have called it wave. Truly speaking, it is never the wave, it is always the ocean, it is always the water. So the first is to recognize the vibhuti in everyday life as we go through it. And that is why we went through each one of those qualities in such detail. The second step is that recognition that this is never separate from the Lord. And that point comes when you're able to look at the entire creation as the Leela Vibhuti and it being nothing but a small wave that comes in this ocean. And when you're able to have that knowledge, that tattva, avikalpena yogena yujyate na trasamshaya, without any doubt, you will reach a state of supreme peace that can never be taken away from you. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode. We will continue the Vibhuti Yoga when we meet next time. I thank you all for your very patient listening and your pleasant company. I most humbly offer this effort at Bhagwan's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment, Outside Inside, Deep Inside. I will join you at 12 for the afternoon satsang. But till I meet you all next week and we resume this Gita pilgrimage, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.